I'll deal with the secondary differentiation in a different way. I'm trying very hard not to prejudge this. I've been doing this for over 20 years, and it's always new to me, too. And I know exactly what's going on, and I'm carrying the structure very accurately, but it is quite different all the time. And this next cycle will have, as I say, the sociological aspect to it, which will change the whole mix. In my meditation 3 nights ago, I could see the need for increasing personal contact with everyone individually to sort of offset the kind of group peer pressure that comes out of a sociological level of not counseling to help you psychologically this way or that, but to agitate for a kind of like a guerrilla attitude to not be swept up in it. Devil's advocate kind of a thing. Teaching you some commando techniques of how to sabotage the group netting quality, which is always very good. And I'm very good at that. I've always been very good at that. Sabotaging groups. It's sort of like the American Brer Rabbit personality. So we've got that done. Let's come to our program. Let's come to science. And hopefully now that I have the 25-page outline finished and typed, and I have paper and a printer that's working, for those who are going on, I'll have copies for you next week, next Saturday. And we'll work out of this manual then for the 2-year cycle. The book itself, which will be several hundred pages, I'll wait until all of the additional writings are finished and done up and edited. And when that's finished, we've got some feelers already for getting it published, both in a practical sense of somebody who has a press who could print it, and also people who have money who will see that it gets done right. That will not come out until next year. But this 25-page outline I'll have for you, those of you who are going to go on with this, pursue this next week. If you remember, one of the texts that we used in the art section was by Kandinsky concerning the spiritual in art. And if you recall, it's available in a little Dover paperback for about $2.50 or $3. And there are copies of that around, concerning the spiritual in art. And we talked at one time about the fact that there are some original Kandinskys in the Los Angeles area. And one of the most powerful ones is at the Norton Simon Museum in Pasadena, called Weighty Circles. And it's generally, I understand, on public display all the time, so that you can go and see Kandinsky's Weighty Circles. That painting was used as the cover for a recent book on science called A Passion for Science, published by Oxford University Press. This volume, A Passion for Science, is the printing up, the publication of a series of interviews done for the BBC 2 years ago of interviewing top scientists in various fields and asking them some fundamental questions What are you doing? How do you feel about what you're doing? What do you think about what you're doing? Things like this. General, humane questions about the process of doing science. And what came out again and again, in fact, was shared by every single one of them, is that the public image of what science is as a method is totally non-operative in science, in fact. For instance, the form of a scientific paper is your introduction, and then the methodology that you used, the results that you got, and then the discussion, the interpretation of what this means, and so forth. Nobody follows that at all. And that in order to put their experience and information, which are different, into publication form, they must distort the experience and skew the information in every instance so that the general public that thinks that they're understanding science because they're reading papers or reading books are in fact conceiving on the basis of these misrepresentations and these skews. And that the gulf between those who are really doing science and the general public who think that they're understanding science has grown monstrously huge. So that in the introduction here, and the whole reason for doing the BBC program was to try and initially calm the public down by having real scientists appear in person. Well, look, they're just like us. But what emerged was this catastrophic realization that the image of scientists has no bearing whatsoever on science. None of the images of science. For those who heard Francis Crick at Caltech, he spoke again and again of the need and importance for gossip. And in fact, one of the people interviewed here was Francis Crick, and his little section is entitled Just Gossiping. In other words, there is an actual process that happens in science that has no relationship whatsoever to the kind of sophomoric forms that have been imposed upon it. Those forms came from the 18th century. Now, when you have 18th century expressive forms for 21st century experience, you can see that the masks are slipping off all over the place, which is why by 1990, you're finding more and more scientists who are yelling, ouch, hey, stop. Here's a page or so from the introduction just to give you a little bit of the tone of why our science section is so difficult. Almost no one is dealing with the science section. These 3 months on science, almost nobody is dealing with it at all on a realistic level. Here's what they write. Present attitudes towards science seem to indicate both ambivalence and polarization. They're different. What is ambivalence? Ambivalence is a feeling-toned quality. What is polarization? Polarization is a thought-thinking-toned. Now, they haven't taken the Saturday course, but people working in the real world on a certain level of maturity in an unconscious way, in a subconscious way, have had to master these kinds of patterns and sequences. There's no way that you can deal on a realistic level with the universe and not have learned some of these patterns. There's no way to do it. Present attitudes towards science seem to indicate both ambivalence and polarization. While there is much interest and admiration for science, there is also a deep-seated fear and hostility. Where is the admiration? The admiration is in thought. Where is the hostility in feeling? In the blood level, human beings are becoming more and more fearful about science as an activity. On the neural level, they're becoming more and more filled with not only admiration, but curiosity. So that if you were to take a psychological profile of the human being by 1990, they would be a very curious kind of a chimera. They would be curious in their minds and fearful in their hearts. Now, if you make an image, a mask image of that ratio, curiosity over hostility, you can see that that is an untenable position for a human being to live in. It's not tenable. You cannot do that. No one can stand that. It doesn't matter how much you are master of your bodily processes. If you disorient your mind to that extent from your body, you're not going to make it. So the only way that it can happen is for one half or the other to dilute the polarized situation. When the body, when the heart, when the blood wants to deal with the mind, it has to deal in a bodily way. So the body engenders a kind of subconscious addictive behavior to drugs, for instance, so as to water the mind down. So it doesn't produce such an intolerable tension. And the mind, of course, works the same way with the body, but instead of doing it on a blood level, it does it on a neural level and creates fantasy. And dilutes the body's effectiveness by giving it a fantasy to deal with, which slows it down. And of course, you can see right away that just in this example, that drugged bodies go along with a fantasy, and it's very, very easy then for an equilibrium to be reached that is completely extraneous to the real. And the body and the mind both agree, oh, well, we're happy. Are you content? Yes, I'm content. Are you content? Well, great. We've both watered each other down to the point to where we can live. But one is living not in a hyper-reality, but one is living in a hypo-reality. The pun is unintended. This is the situation that most of us are trapped in. We live with other beings who have more or less succumbed to this kind of a situation. Some have, with the great purposefulness, plunged into it. Now, anyone who seeks to mature out of this becomes a threat. And so you have to be taught how to be somewhat circumspect and invisible so that you do not become a scapegoat target from your fellow beings. The Prince Myshkin complex. The divine idiot complex. So in the program, I'm conscious of the fact that you need to have ways of disguising yourself, and they're built in. You can never progress far enough unless you learn the techniques of just living with it in a very subtle disguise sort of a way, so that you're not going to outstrip your capacity to deal with the, quote, practical world that you have to find yourself in. Notice here, we're talking from the first chapter of a book on science. Let's start again. Notice that we're coming back, we're not repeating but we're going back with accumulated penetration. We're going to hear the first two sentences again, but with an accumulated penetration. This is a technique which we should have mastered by now. You should be familiar with this by now. It's like the only way to see a constellation in the stars is through accumulated penetration using a visionary matrix. You can't just look and see the constellation. You have to look and shape and reshape what you see. And to be able to see constellations in the starry expanse is the perfect training for developing the capacities out of which thought will work. Once you train the mind, it's almost like introducing a kind of a learning algorithm that permits shaping and reshaping and adjusting, which is characteristic of thought, and not at all necessary in feeling. Feeling, because it's a current, is pretty easily there. You don't have to do too much analysis to know when you're angry or when you're content or when you're hungry. It's there. But in thought, it has to be revised and reshaped. And for really clear thought, that process goes on quite long. It might take you weeks. It might take you sometimes months to understand what it is that you're thinking. It certainly usually takes at least minutes, if not hours, for an idea to be made clear, even when you're trained for it. No one can just speak ideas just like that. Everyone needs to talk. So we're coming back now, and we're using our cumulative penetration to think along with these writers. Here we go. Present attitudes towards science seem to indicate both ambivalence and polarization. While there is much interest and admiration for science, there is also a deep-seated fear and hostility. Science is perceived as materialist and dehumanizing, arrogant and dangerous. Its practitioners are a band of cold and unfeeling technicians wielding power without responsibility. Reductionism is suspect and uncomfortable, sabotaging all the mystery and wonder of life. The threats of nuclear war and the genetic manipulation of embryos looms large. That scientific advance may lead to good or evil ends is undeniable. But the roots of the present anti-science feeling are more tangled than this. In part, they simply reflect the ideas of forbidden knowledge and retribution, which are deeply embedded in Western culture. More interestingly, many of the specific criticisms can be traced directly to the 19th century Romantic movement. Now let's stop there and do a little reflexive circumambulation. In part, they simply reflect the ideas of forbidden knowledge and retribution. These are two distinct but linked in a sequential development ideas, which are ideas of feeling and not ideas of thought. So they are matrices which could be called nexes of feeling rather than ideas. So that we have two nexes of feeling. One, forbidden knowledge. Two, retribution. Now, the classic sequence in which they were sorted out exactly in that 1-2 punch are in the first two books of the Old Testament, the beginnings of the Pentateuch. Forbidden knowledge is the key to the whole development in Genesis, and retribution is the key to the whole development in Exodus. So that if you were to look for really masterful discussion in terms of the nexus of the feeling tones of forbidden knowledge, you'd be hard-pressed to go to a better place than Genesis. Genesis is very, very accurately done. It's a mythic epic of the forbidden knowledge sequence unraveling. A nexus always is able to be opened up, and Genesis does that. In the same horizon, in like kind, and in exact sequence, Genesis is followed by Exodus, and Exodus takes retribution as the nexus and develops that. So that one can go very, very deep into this. These people who are writing this have no idea that this is so. They're not learned in this lore at all. They don't have any background in this. But they speak accurately from their own experience level. It's just that we're in a position here to open this up and show you how universal this is and how extensive one can correlate. Again, more interestingly, many of the specific criticisms can be traced directly to the 19th century Romantic movement. Coleridge was clearly an early anti-reductionist, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, the poet. Coleridge was clearly an early anti-reductionist and was obsessed with the difference between the living whole organism and the idea of the mechanical juxtaposition of parts. A quotation from Coleridge, which I think is from Aids to Reflection, although they don't indicate it here. He wrote, "My mind feels as if it aches to behold and know something great, something one and indivisible." Notice the curiosity tone to the mind. Notice the incompatibility of that curiosity with the heart blood level of feeling about it. Okay? The emphasis in Coleridge is on the thought, and that's why I think it comes from his book Aids to Reflection. At the same time, there was a book which expressed the same relationality, but putting the emphasis on the blood level. That book was Frankenstein by Mary Shelley. At least the ostensible author is Mary Shelley. The book was generated in long conversations throughout many nights between Percy Shelley, Lord Byron, and Mary Shelley and a couple of their other friends. So Frankenstein is really written by Lord Byron, Percy Shelley, and about five or six other friends, and Mary Shelley put her name on it. And she indeed was very literate and very excellent in writing. But the idea is so profound because you had both Byron and Shelley themselves contributing to its the explosive conscious pulse in the idea. The idea of Frankenstein is enormously powerful. Incidentally, Mary Shelley wrote a sequel to Frankenstein, which you'll be interested to hear. Frankenstein deals with the nexus, the feeling nexus of retribution. So that if one were tracing back, the roots of retribution are in the correlate previous nexus of forbidden knowledge. And Mary Shelley wrote a sequel to Frankenstein called The New Adam. and it's published in a reprint in paperback from one of the university presses, maybe the University of Nebraska Press. It's in paperback. The New Adam by Mary Shelley. So you can go from Frankenstein to The New Adam is a very accurate tracing back of from Exodus to Genesis. Now, these were very excellent people. You have to understand, we have weird images that somehow Byron and Shelley were like romantic playboys with their tongues out and were just accidentally spoke gorgeous language. But the fact was is that they were incredibly perceptive and intelligent young men. They both died before, I think Byron was 36 and Shelley was 32. You can see, they're very profound. Coleridge says, "We have purchased a few brilliant inventions at the loss of all communion with life and the spirit of nature." Coleridge wrote that about 150 years ago. The price for a few brilliant inventions has been the loss of communion with all of nature and with life itself. That was apparent 150 years ago. Not just to Coleridge. I mean, there was a whole population of human beings who were very much aware of it at that time, who tried to deal with it. They write here, this is an introduction to a book on science. In the same theme, D.H. Lawrence took up this and wrote, "The universe is dead for us, and how is it to come alive again?" Any of you who know the work of D.H. Lawrence know Lawrence is about 100 years after Coleridge, about 50 years ago, and one of the main themes of D.H. Lawrence is the wisdom of blood. The whole thing in Lady Chatterley's Lover is not about lust, it's about the need for the blood level of life to express itself legitimately in terms of which it exists. And to think that it's improper because the idea of it is not in sync with the mores of the particular society of the time is a madness. It's madness to think that sexuality is dirty because the Victorian milieu decrees it so as an idea. It's an affront against life. Mother Nature is not a whore. Notice that we're following here, a little dramatically now, but we're following in the preface to this discussion of science why it is that science is so terrifying and yet so alluring at the same time, and why us, late 20th century human beings, are caught in an impossible dilemma. The ancient mythic image is that one. One is caught on the horns of a dilemma. This is how the machine cooperates. The demonic here. One is caught on the horns of a dilemma. I think in the military, the phrase is damned if you do and damned if you don't. Lawrence wrote, and I'm not quite sure just where this is. They may give us the quotation here for Lawrence. Well, they don't. It's in one of his essays. I'm sorry, I don't remember where it was. "The universe is dead for us. And how is it to come alive again? Knowledge, so-called, has killed the sun, making it a ball of gas with spots. Knowledge so-called has killed the moon. It is a dead little earth fretted with extinct craters as with smallpox. The world of reason and science, this is the dry and sterile world the abstracted mind inhabits. D.H. Lawrence's powerful language. Mary Shelley's Dr. Frankenstein is the epitome of the scientist unleashing forces he cannot control. And so powerful is the image that it has become part of 20th century popular culture, shorthand and emblem of the dangers of science. In other words, Frankenstein is a mythic image, very, very powerful mythic image. Joseph Campbell keeps saying we need a new myth. Well, Shelley and Byron provided a new myth a couple hundred years ago, and the difficulty is we don't want to hear that. We don't like that myth because it makes us very uncomfortable. And notice what has correlated itself around the mythic image of Frankenstein. Dracula, the wolf man. I mean, if you want to see a really accurate presentation of that mythic figure, you have to go to the comic angle of that feeling tone nexus. The best ever done is the one where Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein. There it is. And you can see it in the genius of Abbott and Costello. That's it. Okay, back to our intro. All these images come not from scientists, but from poets and writers. It was Mary Shelley who created the monster, not science. And it is not just an irony that this should be so. It suggests that at least a part of the antipathy stems from the difficulties non-scientists have in understanding science. Now, they're going to make a point here, which is fairly interesting to consider, but I need to leaven that because you must understand that Percy Shelley knew science perfectly well. He wasn't writing poetry when he was a teenager. He was experimenting with his chemicals. He blew up the house, the Shelley household. They disinherited him because he was, in fact, a mad scientist at about 14. Total. He turned to poetry later on, but understood a great deal of science. But the point they're making is this, which is worth taking. Scientists themselves must take some of the blame for this. With notable exceptions, they have tended to be reluctant to explain themselves to the public at large. But the problem may go deeper. There is some evidence that the scientific mode of thought is neither natural nor comfortable. From what we said this morning, you can see that scientific thought indeed is not natural. It's not a blood current flow. It's a neuronal group pulse mode and is indeed not only antithetical, but is in a very subtle way complementarity to the other. Notice that unless you can bring the two together, unless you can have them as complementarity and bring them together into a unity, they decay into an antipathy. And that antipathy does two things simultaneously. It polarizes the thought, and it makes ambivalent the feeling. Now, you can see immediately what happens to a personality. You're unsure of how you feel about it, and you're absolutely sure that they're the bad guys. Thought is polarized, and feelings become ambiguous. And you can see that one is caught in a double projection. You're unsure about yourself, but you're absolutely convinced that they're wrong. And modern man is caught in that kind of horns of a dilemma. Everyone is. There's no one that's exempt from that. What we're trying to do is extricate ourselves in some real way from this dilemma, but it takes all of this time to do that. It takes all of this complexity of the two-year sequence to do that. Because the problem is so labyrinthian and subtle that if you don't take it as a whole, what happens is that you leak psychic energy and create an autonomous, split-off consciousness. And then instead of just having one problem, then you have a couple of problems. And if you think it's hard to live now, if you're schizophrenic, it would be much harder to live. Much, much harder to live. But notice that the schizophrenic fragmenting becomes an inescapable human condition of adjustment. Do we need to stop there? Let's change our tapes. Shall we do that? Let's come back to a very powerful realization. What increasingly passes as the acceptable social norm is adaptation to a schizophrenic comportment. If you feel out of place, it's because you are out of place. If you think things are not right, it's because things are not right. If you look back at the furrow of the life that you have had to live the last 30 years and you see it wobble, that's why it wobbles. Sometimes it looks like a pretzel when you look back. You look at your life path and you think, oh, I'm lucky to even be here. With all the convolutions and all the salt and all the heat, I'm lucky I made it. And were you not to have an eternal, wise spirit, you would not have made it at all. Nobody would have. It's like one of the proofs positive. If we were only epiphenomenon of the actual situation that obtains, we would have perished long ago. The not only is the deck stacked against you, and not only is the dealer crooked with a stacked deck, but you were not given real money in the first place. It's a horrendous thing, tragic view of life, but it has its comic aspect because it doesn't matter anyway. That's the fairy tale aspect of it. You come to the point where you realize that you never had a chance. This world never gave you a chance. And then the kicker, the chuckle, is that it doesn't matter anyway. You don't need chances. You're quite real, despite what the world does. The laughter of the gods. Let's come back here just for about 12 more lines, okay? But the problem may go deeper. There is some evidence that the scientific mode of thought is neither natural nor comfortable. And indeed, it is not in a natural current flow like blood, but is in a pulse mode like thought. That's why there's no science on the mythic level. There's no facility for it to occur, except in an invisible, numinous way as the background. But conversely, in science, the blood flow current level of psychic activity, even though it's not there in a visible conscious way, is always there in the subconscious invisible way. numinously. Now, one can, with being alert, you can be doing science and have an extremely powerful deja vu quality that what you are doing is mythically sensible and important. I've had this several times. When you're using pulse mode psychic energy to its nth degree in a scientific apex, you can suddenly have a numinous experience that this is the ceremony that your people have done forever in ancient antiquity. Your people have always done this, and this is a ceremony of renewal. And it's disturbing if one is not used to it. It can be disturbing. There's some evidence, then, that the scientific mode of thought is neither natural nor comfortable. Experimental work by psychologists shows that people rely on a limited number of principles which reduce the complex task of assessing probabilities to simpler judgmental operations. That is, they shift gears down to blood flow level, because the pulse phase level too much. What happens if you stuff the heart with too many thoughts? It makes it sick. Because the heart is made for blood and not for neural impulses on the ideational level. Can't handle it. The same thing, conversely, what happens when you put too much or too little blood to the brain? You red out or you black out. Just can't function. It's the wrong energy. Just enough is just right. Too much or too little doesn't work. So the heart redouts or blacks out with too many ideas or too few ideas. Experimental work by psychologists show that people rely on a limited number of principles which reduce the complex task of assessing probabilities to simpler judgmental operations. In a very simple example, people expect that a sequence of random events, such as tossing a coin, is more likely to yield head, tails, head, tails, head, tails, than head, 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 head. Which is, in fact, not the case. It's just as rare to have head, tails, head, tails, head, tails, as to have head, 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 head. The probabilities are the same for both sets. But when you're working on blood level, the accuracy of that thought doesn't ever occur to you. And you're convinced that somebody who is heads all the time is an aberrant. And the only normal person is the person whose heads and tails equal it. Do you see how traditional tribal values, how exclusive sociological groups can distort the real without even understanding that the distortion is taking place? And where does this manifest itself? In the higher energy levels of thought. When thought is completing its patterning capacity, these very problems become more and more, they become asymptotically possible. The probability rises asymptotically so that it becomes extremely perilous to have consciousness. Very, very perilous. There's a certain critical takeoff point after which, the phrase I heard one time in Berkeley, if I honed my consciousness anymore, the point would break. The studies show that thinking statistically is not only difficult for many people, but an alienating activity. What does it alienate? It alienates the head from the heart, increasingly. Why? Because there was a split in the first place. It isn't that increased psychic energy creates the split, it's that it just augments what already has occurred. You think, oh, well, I'm having a hard time because I'm nervous. I've got too much energy. I've got to cut my energy level down. I'll take 2 yellows, 2 pinks, and 2 greens. That's not it at all. The psychic energy doesn't cause the split. There's no demonic or angelic quality to psychic energy. But when the fractionating forms are there, the psychic energy cooperates with those forms, and with a split form, the psychic energy will manifest a split. And the more that you feed it, the more that the split becomes a gulf. As Bertrand Russell, they write, as Bertrand Russell pointed out, when it comes to assigning causes to events, popular induction depends on the emotional interest of the instances, not upon their number.